access number 16656, reel 1.
Mr. Todd, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Blackheel, County Durham.
Where's that near?
Near Consett.
Which year was this?
1928.
Do you have any significant Second World War memories that we ought to record?
Yes, I do have. Well, there, it would be of interest. Many of the bombing raids, of course.
Where was this?
I lived in a village called Dipton, which has a view over the Tyne Valley, looking down towards Gates at Newcastle. And as boys, we used to go out at night and watch the bombing raids on Newcastle when they were taking place. And there was a change in the anti-aircraft tactics, whereby one night all the searchlights locked onto one plane and ignored the others. All the guns appeared to fire at that one plane. And eventually, of course, it came down in flames, and then the searchlights selected another plane. And after that, they kept up that tactic. The other memory I have clearly is of camping out with the Boy Scouts near Consett and watching the bombers go out, our bombers, going out in neat formation early in the evening, and then coming back in pairs or singly later in the morning, maybe 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And of course, as boys, we always used to try to count them out and count how many were coming back.
Which year do you think it might have been that you saw that plane brought down?
42 or 43, I would think. It was whilst the raids were heaviest on the north of England.
Now, how did you come to be in the forces yourself?
I'd always wanted to join the Navy from a very early age. I did know about the Royal Marines. One of our neighbours in the village I was brought up in, Dipton, her brother had been killed during the Zeebrugge raid in the First World War, and she had a large photograph of this man who was wearing a sailor's hat but with a Royal Marine badge on the front. That's, you know, the no peak. And she used to tell me all about her brother and the Marines, but mainly I wanted to join the Navy. I became a sea cadet. I went to the recruiting office for the Navy, and somehow or other the chief petty officer there diverted me into the Royal Marines. Good move.
Which year was this?
That was 1945.
Now, jumping ahead, I think you were involved in a very early brush with the Argentinians over the Falklands. Can you tell me when and how that came about?
Yes, I was aboard HMS Nigeria, part of the Royal Marines Detachment. I was there from 46 to 48, and we got urgent recall. We'd been on shore leave in South Africa, and the message was that we were going to the Falklands. Of course, we had not the faintest idea of where the Falkland Islands were. The problem was that Argentine and Chilean troops or scientists were moving in on British bases in the Antarctic rather than the Falklands itself. So the ship went down to the Falklands, and in company with a smaller frigate, Sparrow, HMS Sparrow, we went round these various bases presenting protests to the Argentines and Chileans. Mainly it was a show of force, which appeared to work. We didn't hear any more about it for another few years.
Did you see anything of their forces?
Only the ones we saw on shore, and it was difficult to tell who were forces and who were scientists. Cold weather clothing, couldn't tell the difference.
Do you think, was it the Argentinians and the Chileans?
Separately, yes, on separate bases. There was a lot of interest in the Antarctic at that time, and I think they were trying to establish a foothold. not so much the Falkland Islands themselves, though the Falklanders were at that time very worried about it, the Argentines. I think they were trying to get a foothold on Antarctica itself.
So, do you think they were impressed, suitably?
We didn't hear any more for a long time.
And you actually went to the Antarctic continent?
Yes, to Deception Island, South Shetlands, I think. Admiralty Bay was another name which cropped up.
When was this? Which year? 47?
48.
So it must have been the early months of
48. Early months, yes.
In their summer?
Yes.
In the Antarctic?
Oh, yes. Thankfully.
Any other things that happened on that occasion?
In the Antarctic, you mean?
Yes.
No, not really. I was very impressed with the scenery, the size of the icebergs. Of course, people pay thousands now just to go down there.
But you didn't actually go ashore?
No.
Now, coming on to 1949, the time of the Amethyst incident in the Yangtze, you were on the edges of that somehow. Can you tell me how?
Yes, at the time we were in Bermuda with the West Indies squadron. They had two cruisers, Jamaica and Glasgow. And we just had a cup final with two Royal Marine teams playing in the final. And we were summoned back on board with the news that we were going to the Far East to replace either Belfast or London, which had been damaged in the attempts to get Amethyst out of the Yangtze. So we then, as the youngest or the newest cruiser on the station, Jamaica was transferred to Hong Kong, which was an interesting voyage. We'd already been through Panama twice, Panama Canal, but this time, on going through Panama, we had presents sent up to us from the British communities in Chile that we'd previously visited. And, of course, we got a great reception in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the Americans, who were not at that time involved with the communists in any big way. And we refueled and went on to Hong Kong. We were fortunate enough to be near the mouth of the Yangtze when word came that Amethyst was making her breakout. And it was quite an emotional scene when she did get out without any assistance from any other ship of the Royal Navy. And as they were both Plymouth ships, they were crew were calling Oggy 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 over. We had her mail on board, a lot of mail, and transferred a few crates of beer. They'd run out during the time they were trapped.
What is this Oggy Oggy Oggy?
Well, an oggy is a Cornish pasty, and at that time the Navy was split into Devonport, Portsmouth and Chatham divisions, and almost as a term of derision, the other divisions used to call us Devonians, Oggy Oggy, or a bunch of Oggies. But we used it to cheer on our football teams and rugby teams.
In what way was it so emotional to see the Amethyst come out?
She was full of shell holes. I still have a photograph of her. She was very much battered, but the spirit was terrific. And of course, there was a lot of cheering going across between the two ships.
Do you remember the outbreak of the Korean War?
Very clearly.
What happened to you?
I was on board HMS Jamaica as part of the ship's company, a corporal at the time, and we were somewhere off Okinawa on a morning, and I think it was probably a weekend or Sunday morning, because we were all sitting on the mess deck, and over the ship's tannoy system, we got the world news, including a snippet about the North Korea had invaded South Korea. Once more, very few of the detachment knew where Korea was, but those who'd been with the Marines in the Pacific area during World War II, they knew about it because they'd met Korean guards in prison camps. So that was the first we heard, but within an hour or so, the ship diverted and started making tracks towards Korea. And I think it was the following day there was an announcement that Britain had joined with the United Nations forces when they managed to get the vote through at the United Nations headquarters that we would take part on the side of South Korea. So it was quite exciting. We're glad to be going.
Why?
How shall I say? We were all regular Marines and sailors, and those of us who had not seen active service in World War II used to feel as though we'd missed out on something, almost being like second-class citizens against those who had chestfuls of medals, and this was a chance to see some real active service.
Did you feel that, like that later when the active service actually started?
Yes, whilst we were winning, yes. Only when we started to lose out a little did I have second thoughts.
We'll come to that later. How did you come to be a member of 41 Independent Commander?
By accident. The ship's duty in company with HMS Black Swan, a frigate, and frequently with the United States ship Juno, which was a 5-inch anti-aircraft cruiser. We would cover both east and west coast of Korea, trying to destroy communications of the North Koreans. The North Korean army was sweeping into South Korea, but most of the roads and rail seemed to be near the coast, and we were able to do a lot of damage. But the trains and troops were able to shelter in tunnels, mainly on the east coast. We did have one suggestion from a torpedo officer that a bunch of Royal Marines should land with a depth charge and put it in a tunnel and destroy the tunnel that way. Destroying the railway lines was only a temporary job because they could repair them almost overnight. Fortunately, the torpedo officer was not allowed to go ahead with this idea. I can't imagine trundling depth charges along the... first of all, in a small boat, and then trying to get them inshore into the tunnel. But then there was a call for volunteers from the fleet for a small raiding party, which would do the same kind of job, but with proper explosives, and being trained and presumably led by American Navy or American Marines. I volunteered for that party. This party was eventually slimmed down considerably. We joined up with an American Army Raider Company, but whilst we were getting ready to leave for Korea, 41 Commando arrived, and we were informed that we would be absorbed into 41 Commando, though we would continue with the raids until 41 Commando was trained up. So off we went for the Incheon landings. We did a small raid before the Incheon landing, which we now find out was diversionary, but at the time we thought it was a reconnaissance raid.
What happened on that raid?
Took place... Name was Kunsan. It was south of Incheon, and the raid was split. The beach was split into two. One part of the beach was to be reconnoitred by the United States Army Raider Company, and the other half, separated by a promontory from the American half, would be carried out by the Fleet Volunteers, led at this time by a Royal Marine officer. Derek Pounds, who retired, still alive, Major General Pounds. It wasn't a clean raid in that we had to pass small islands to get to the mainland, and we could see signalling of some sort going between the islands, lights flashing. Fortunately, on our side of the beach, we hit a sandbar about 150 yards short of the beach and had to carry lift our boats over this sandbar, which delayed our arrival on the main part of the shore. The Americans, they were on the far side, and there were too many of them, in my opinion, for a reconnaissance raid. They had about 110 to our 12. They made quite a bit of noise and came under fire. Eventually, we started to come under fire. That's the British part. But it was very inaccurate. We were able to start on the reconnaissance, and then by radio we were contacted and told to withdraw. So as a reconnaissance, we felt that it was an absolute failure. The Americans had two casualties, a lieutenant and a corporal. Corporal was brought back on board. The lieutenant, they'd had to leave him on one of the islands on the way back. So we were very despondent about this. We thought the whole raid was a failure. 38 years later, I read that this was quite successful. The pure intention of this raid was to divert attention away from Incheon, which happened within 36 hours. And, of course, they had very little resistance to Incheon, so it may have worked. It took a long time to find out.
What were you carrying with you when you went ashore?
I was carrying at that time the United States carbine, which was a 30 caliber lightweight. It looked like a rifle, very much a Hollywood weapon. It could be fired on automatic, and was abandoned entirely by 41 Commando because we found it had no hitting power, was unreliable under active service conditions, and it really hadn't got the range. The United States Marines that we served with, they also switched around to this. We got rid of them and got rifles. But not a good weapon.
And what rank did you have at the time?
I was corporal.
And who led your party?
Lieutenant Pounds. We had a petty officer, Tate, with us, who was killed later at Chosin Reservoir. And a leading seaman, John Futcher, who the last I saw of him, he was lieutenant commander in charge of the fleet clearance diving team searching for the body of Malcolm Campbell in Ullswater.
Now, can we come on to the Incheon landings and what in detail you remember of it from your own personal point of view, please?
Yes. Because we'd been on this reconnaissance raid, we had no knowledge that Incheon was going to happen. It would have been too dangerous, I suppose, had we been taken prisoner. We were raiding from the HMS Whitsun Bay, small frigate. And we were on the trying to sleep on the upper deck of the Whitsun Bay when we heard this terrific bombardment from all around us. And as the light dawn broke, we could see that there was this massive fleet carrying out a bombardment of what we later found to be Incheon. We were unable to take part in the early landings, but Mr. Pounds, who was our boss, he managed to negotiate a landing later on the, I think it was early on the second day of the raids. The intention was that we should have been landed by boat to try to capture Kimpo Airfield. That is, the raider company and the Royal Marines should have captured Kimpo Airfield and held it until the 5th Marines of the United States Marine Corps could relieve us. In the event, we were unable to do this, so we decided to try to do the same thing by road. But the American Marines were far too fast. But we were coming up behind them, but they'd taken Kimpo Airfield before we arrived. Memories. One civilian-type soldier, a boffin of some kind. He'd hoped to get into Kimberware Field to recover some bomb sight from one of the Russian planes which had been destroyed on the ground. And on arrival, he found that the plane had been absolutely stripped for souvenirs by the, presumably, the first American Marines to arrive there. So he was very disconsolate. But, there were other things happening. Nobody was bothered too much about him. And the other thing I remember about Kimpo were just the piles of bodies there. Been quite a slaughter before we arrived. Not ours, theirs.
Soldiers or civilians?
Oh, soldiers, yeah. From Kimpo Airfield, we branched out to the left, to the west coast. This time, still with the raider company, but we teamed up with the 14th South Korean Marine Battalion, and the intention was to look for guerrillas or stragglers on the high ground on the Han River Peninsula. And we continued to do this, rounding up quite a few, incidentally, until eventually we were recalled to take part with 4-1 Commando in the coastal raids on the east coast. This was late October.
Which month was Incheon?
September 15th, the landing.
You were telling me earlier that you saw something of the hard way in which the South Koreans treated their own people at Incheon.
Yes, we did see quite a bit of this, but it appeared to be common in the Far East that the life was seen to be rather cheap.
What did these October raids consist of?
Straightforward raiding activity, destroying tunnels and bridges. Because we were now operating with a highly professional unit, which was 4-1 Independent Commando, life was a lot easier. We had engineers, SBS men. Reconnaissance was carried out properly before the landing. We could land, carry up to nearly 2 tons of explosives, place these in the tunnels, blast the tunnels. That we did 2 raids. The first night we did a tunnel only, and the second night we did a tunnel and a bridge, both of which were successful. I think that we used probably a little too much explosive in one of the tunnels, because even though I think there was about a 33 minute delay to allow us to get clear, which meant that we could get off the beach and paddle some distance offshore before the charge went up. There were a variety of fuses placed on this so that should one fail, another one would cut in. And additional to this, there was a small party, 2 or 3 men, would stay on shore, and they would not leave until after the explosion. You know, if the time ran out, they would go back and explode it by other means. But the tunnel that we'd put the most explosive in, the ideal way is to shatter the roof and so that all the debris falls into the tunnel. It takes a long time to clear. On that first occasion, I think that they probably ended up with a cutting rather than a tunnel, because it blew the whole hillside away above the tunnel. A lot of the trees appeared to catch fire, and even though by this time we must have been, that's my little group, must have been 800 yards away from the explosion itself, the debris was falling down and making the sea boil around the rubber boats. I was scared at that time. I really was scared, because all these bits of timber and rock were flopping back in. But the raids were successful. I say they were carried out in a very professional manner, and whereas the Americans had been enthusiastic amateurs, don't forget they'd been lying around for 5 years in Japan enjoying a very luxurious life, and really this was just something they thought they'd like to do. These other people were highly well trained. I was pleased to be with them.
How many raids did you go on personally?
Two. That's two with the 4-1 commando and one with the raider company.
And how much difference was there between the two raids?
In what way?
In any way?
Professionalism. The first raid, that was the with the raider company, of course, was not intended to be a reconnaissance raid at all. It was intended to be a diversionary raid, which was probably why they put so many men ashore and carrying too many weapons, making too much noise. The second raid, as I say, was intended to destroy the tunnels or bridges, and that's just what we did.
And the second raid was on the east coast?
Yes, the second and third raids on the east coast, yeah. Civilians were rounded up and put into a place of safety so that there'd be no damage. I think that on one of the raids there was a sentry that had to be killed, but generally great care was taken to see that there was no harm to the civilian population.
And casualties amongst the commandos?
We had one on the first raid and none on the on the second.
What was the name of the places that you raided? Did you know?
I could tell you. I have it upstairs, but I haven't got it in my memory.
It'll be on the record.
Yeah.
Was how much fear was there for you on these two raids?
Interesting. With all these kind of raids, I found that the most stressed, or the persons who were most stressed, were the sailors who stayed on the ships. The people going on the raids were generally not particularly stressful. There's always a moment of anxiety when you're paddling through the night, particularly if it's a clear night, if anyone has spotted you on shore, because if they know the business, they will wait until you actually within a couple of hundred yards and can't get away and could mow you down. But once you've got your feet on the ground, it just becomes a job. There's no stress, no fear. Just carry on and carry out whatever is being planned.
Was there a sense of success after these two raids?
Very much so. After the second raid, we were operating from an American assault personnel destroyer, the USS Wontuck. Half of the commando was operating from the Horace A. Bass, which was in company. And we had a party, but after the second raid, the Americans put on a party for us, at something like 3 o'clock in the morning. Broke out some medicinal brandy, which American ships are not supposed to do. It wasn't really brandy, it was the Japanese Suntory whiskey, but...
And after the two raids?
We went back to Japan for further training. We still had a lot of training to do on American weapons. It was already beginning to get rather cold. One of the patrols from 4-1 Commando had also been raiding from the submarine, the USS Perch, further down the coast. So this gave us a chance to train as a unit rather than in small detached patrols or troops, because there had been three patrols in 4-1 Commando plus the fleet volunteers who virtually had been working independently. So this then gave us a chance to operate as a